Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another video. I have Todd Lewis back, and he wants to talk about Molberg again. We talked about Curtis Yarvin, Mencius Molberg last week. You know, it's been enough time, Todd, that quite a lot of people didn't realize that Yarvin was Molberg. So that's probably something that I need to explain. But anyway, we're going to get to this because last time we focused on what. Today we're going to focus on how exactly, in your theory, he, quote, played the right. Just before we get going, I have to remind everyone that my new book, Foundations of Shakespeare, is out. Now my lovely copy is covered in cigar smoke. You know, Todd, I was thinking of retiring this smoking jacket, you know, and just wearing like academic tweed for the rest of the year, as I have been. But I decided that, one, I really wanted this cigar, and a smoking jacket is required to protect your clothes from smoke. But two, you know, one of the reasons I was thinking of retiring it is because if I wear it, half the comments are about the jacket, which kind of winds me up. However, every time I have you on, I would say about a third of the comments are about your beard. So I thought, well, if I wear the jacket, it might help to even out the beard comments. Okay. But people want me to raise, like, I mean, they're kind of like 50-50 between people saying it's some sort of like Western Confucius type figure and other people just saying that you should shave it off. So I don't know if you want to address that. Do you want to defend your beard before we get going?
Well, I'll just say I've been called Lenin or Confucius, so we'll split the difference.
All right. I have a sale on at the moment. Promo code is Shorjan. I'll play the advert. Todd is sick of it, but I have to pay the bills here. Promo code Shorjan, 25% off all courses. If you get Foundations of Shakespeare, give the receipt to the publisher. They will give you 50% off this amazing edition here, kind of designed to go with the course. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Curtis Yarvin / Mencius Molberg.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code Shorjan for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
All right, we're back. And if people are wondering, the cigar is a Juan Lopez Seleccione number one, more elegant cigar from a more civilized age. But we want to talk about, well, you want to talk about, Todd, the problem of Yarvin Molberg. Now, we've already talked about the basic ideas, some of the basic issues with Yarvin in a previous video. So you can go back and watch that if you haven't seen it. But on this one, you wanted to actually elaborate on the specific mechanisms he used, how he did it, what he was trying to achieve, etc. So I'll mute myself and let you take it away.
All right. So just as a brief recap for those that haven't seen or haven't seen in a while, the theory that I'm running with is that Molberg was playing the right as a kind of psychological warfare operation, a psyop, where he's basically getting them to work for him and his people without them realizing it, while thinking actually that they're fighting against him and his people. So that's the basic. So then how is he doing this? Well, the short answer, which I'll then expand on, is that Molberg and his philosophy teaches a sort of fetishization of power. So the idea is, okay, the higher up on the power scale you are, the more valuable you are. You need to look up to that person and help that person get power, because that person will then, you know, one day help you get power. Of course, you know, there's the Lucy Charlie Brown and the football with the Dark Elves and Hobbits essays on Grey Mirror, where he says, well, actually, no, you're never going to get power, guys. So just, you know, leave me alone. But here's the thing, right? If we look at the United States today and we look at the power structures that exist, who sits at the top? Well, it's financial interests. It's the oligarchy. And as your audience well knows, the Dark Elves sit at the top of that hierarchy. So if you have dissident right-wing guys going into the marketplace, you know, doing the Sigma grind set, working, trying to get careers, and they're constantly looking at people who are higher up in the power hierarchy than they are, and they're just, you know, doing what they want because, hey, that's just the smart mold-bugging thing to do, well, odds are it's a Dark Elf. Odds are a Dark Elf sitting up higher up on the hierarchy than you. And so you're working for him, doing what he wants, while at the same time you think you're working against him and for yourself. And it's kind of an unthinking flow state. Like, you get programmed into it, because if you contrast this with, say, like a socialist or a anarchist or a Marxist perspective, you see people in the oligarchy with more money than you, you take direct action. You don't sit around and try to placate them or try to grease the wheels. No, you take direct action. You take it for yourself. Okay, so that's kibosh. Don't do that. Mold bugs, like, that's bad. Don't do that. So you keep the oligarchy in place. You do your Sigma grind set, trying to raise, you know, get promoted through corporate. And what ends up happening is you just reflexively think, oh, this guy has more power than me. This guy's higher up in the hierarchy than me. Therefore, I should just do what he says and listen to him. Turns out, as we all well know, most of those people, a lot of them are Dark Elves. And so without even realizing it, you're working for them while you think you're working against them. And it's kind of this unthinking flow state that Moldbug sort of doesn't want you to ask that question. He assumes you won't. And I think history is borne out. Moldbug was right. They didn't ask that question. And so what ends up happening is you're doing your Sigma grind set thinking you're some undercover, you know, alt-right guy trying to blow up the Death Star, when in reality you're working for a Dark Elf. And so that's the mechanics of how he got people to do that. They're actually, I mean, I've known guys who are alt-right, whose employer is a Dark Elf, and they actually think they're undercutting this guy. They think they're actually fighting this guy when he's a millionaire and they're just, you know, scratching for pennies. It's farcical.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things to touch on here. One of the odd aspects of Yavin that I've always found is that he is genuinely drawn to the notion of status and being an elite, which is to say, he himself is kind of quite openly driven by the notion of social status conferred by what circles you move in, who you know, and all this sort of stuff, which in and of itself can't be revolutionary if you think about it, right? It just cannot, like, you cannot be a revolutionary and also what Carlyle would call a gig man or part of gigmanity, right? That's one part of it. Another thing is that I remember when I gave the talk many years ago, this talk is now collected in Applied Elite Theory. But the talk was called The Octopus. Tens of thousands of people have watched this talk now, because it's been online for a while. And that talk was designed in some respects to counter the model of the cathedral, or the Yavin model. And if you recall, I had the different parts of the octopus, okay, and I call them like the head and the mouth and all this sort of stuff. And right at the beating heart of it, right at the center, the thing that made everything else tick was what I call the chest, okay? What somebody like Spengler would have called the money power. We're talking about the banks, the Black Rocks, and so on and so forth. And I mean, to give a bit of context to that talk, this was coming out of COVID, coming out of a moment where it really looked like the people in control were what we'd call the globalists now, or the Davos crowd, okay? At that time, a lot of things have happened since, which means that you need to kind of finesse some of the stuff I was saying there. I'll come on to that in a second. But Mulwick was there. He was sitting in the crowd. Yavin was there. And he said his response was to say, well, are you a Marxist? Because you sound like a Marxist. And then he wrote an essay in his Grey Mirror the following week. He didn't directly say it was about this, but it was clearly a response to what I had said. And his thesis was, money has no power. Money has no power. And the counterfactual he put was, imagine now that Larry Fink came out tomorrow as a Nazi, that he's a Hitler supporter. Would that be acceptable to the regime, or would Larry Fink be brought down, or would even BlackRock be brought down, or something like this? And so he was saying, like, look, you've got to understand, it's the taste makers. It's the makers of dreams. It's the media. They have the power, not the money men. Now, what's interesting to me, Todd, is that we have had a near perfect real life experiment to see who was right. Was it me? I said it was the money power. Or was it Yavin who said, oh, well, it's all about ideology and it's all about the media? In the years since, there's been what many people call the genocide in Gaza. There has been pretty much as close as you can come to mask off, all out. You know, that has happened. And yet it's the money men who won out, from what I can tell, not the pro-Palestine mobs or the left. In fact, they have had their wings clipped. They have been arrested in large numbers. They have been told they have had their funding pulled. They've been kicked out off campus. They have been, in no uncertain terms, told that they're not allowed to do this by order of the state. So to me, that answered the question. It was the billionaires who got their way, not the far-left activists. The ideology, at the end, didn't matter. But anyway, I don't want to digress too much. What do you say to all of this, Todd?
I would agree 100%. One new left radical named Kunin wrote a book called The Strawberry Statement, where he says that on the street, there was a slang term for Rockefeller money called ESSO, E-S-S-O. And he said that he talked to one of these ESSO dealers at one point, and he said, look, we fund you guys to be far-left kooks to make the guys I work for look centrist so that we can push our policies in a conservative country. So what happens is they want to shift the needle to the left. This is the 60s. They then put money behind these radical movements that scare normal people into making a compromise with the nudge. They're just moving it a little bit, but, you know, just enough to, quote, defang the radicals. And so this is an old habit, right? And so when you talk about the pro-Palestine groups, the groups that were, you know, against Israel, they were also, in at least at one stage earlier in this process, held up by that same money. And it's no longer useful now, right? We've seen this with the feminists, the TERFs, and the trans, right? So feminism, TERF, used to be cutting edge. It was cutting edge in the 90s. Now it's just yesterday's trash, right? Because they were propped up by this same system. So it's a carousel. There's a carousel where these horses keep moving around and around, and, you know, who's running it? It's the money power. And none of these people that we see on the carousel really are there because they have power. They're there because they are allowed to be there. We see this also with COVID, all the doctors that didn't go along with the prognosis. They got fired. I mean, they were at the top of their career. These were career scientists, doctors, right? These were not nobodies. Didn't matter. Once that memo got out, boom. You know, as far as money not having power, I remember that. And my thought was, well, that's ridiculous. You know, Bill Gates wants to have everybody vaccinated on the planet, and he gets about 70% vaccinated. Wow, that's a lot of money, right? That's power.
Yeah, the process you're describing is in juvenile, of course, or better articulated, you could argue, by C.A. Bond in Nemesis, a figure who's been largely vindicated, by the way. C.A. Bond, if people don't know, was run off the internet for calling out money behind certain people, and he was basically bullied offline back in 2022. All of the things he said have come to are now widely recognized as common knowledge. But yeah, this is the high-low middle mechanism, where the high is power or money power, and the low are client groups who have, in the final analysis, no power. That is, when the powers that be decide that their usefulness is over, they can be dispensed with, or they can be sidelined, or they can be put back in their cages. And they, and as you say, this has happened with various left-wing groups who've been picked up and dropped. Look at Greta Thunberg. Greta Thunberg, yes. When she was doing the thing that the system wanted, net zero carbon stuff, she was a cock of the walk. Now she's a pro-Palestinian activist, you know, no longer venerated, no longer. She's now, I mean, for me, this was like amazing. It was the one authentic thing Greta Thunberg did in her entire life, but clearly been dropped by those same forces. Now, to come back to what I was talking about a second ago, when I said that the octopus theory needs a little bit of tweaking now, is that there were things that have become clear that were not clear when I gave that talk, or they weren't, like the receipts were not there, but now the receipts are there. And one of the things was that all of the NGO networks and the, you know, the asset managers and the foundations and so on, you know, that looked like a big decentralized network with no, you know, it was kind of like it just is the bankers or something. Since then, and you can agree or disagree, for me, it's become quite clear that a lot of it is just the US government. Like a lot of it is just what we would call the military industrial complex, who use, I mean, and in fairness, Elon Musk actually gave the, when he did the US aid reveal, he basically revealed that the whole network goes back to USG. Other documents have come to light since. There was something going around last week in the French government, French diversity pushes, DEI, immigration in France now, was coming through as a direct condition from American imperial overlords. That is, it was coming through as a diktat from Washington that the French government would then have to decide what to do with. Okay? So when I say it's just the US government, the US government does use all these other bodies, right? The Black Rocks and the foundations and so on. But when push comes to shove, these foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, etc., are massive black holes. Nobody ever audits them. So if you're the CIA, or if you're the US military or US government even, and you wanted to stick, I don't know, a couple of billion dollars somewhere, right? You could use this network that's built up for your own ends. You know, and this is discussed by a book that we touched on in the past called Who Paid the Piper, which actually showed a previous iteration of this. But it strikes me that I couldn't have possibly known that back then. And I still think that there's some disjunction between what the kind of truly hardcore Zio-led Republican crowd want and what the Davos crowd want. But it strikes me that if my octopus overlooked anything, it was just that how much is downstream of the US security state. I'll just put it that way. Do you agree with all that?
Well, I would agree that the US security state is a highly influential and powerful force in all of this. But I would say that, one, the security state itself was a creation of this oligarchy that we've been talking about. Because if we look at the rise of U.S. intervention around the world on a routine basis, so prior to World War One, you don't really see this. And then World War One was the first attempt, you know, the League of Nations, that didn't work out. Then isolationism was still a strong principle in this country. And then you go to World War II, and then after that, the United States is always intervening all over the world. So part of this is the national security state was created to secure resources for these corporate interests. A good example would be Cuba during the Spanish-American War for the sugar interests. Now, of course, it has a life of its own. It exerts its own will and influence. So I think what we're seeing is a formerly junior partner that has now expanded to near peer status. And now, of course, it's more of a balancing act than one group taking orders from the other. Because Of course, you also got to include the technocrats like Elon Musk and others who do the R&D research. Well, the security state needs advanced technologies for its weapon systems and communications, but that needs to be funded in the private sector, and that needs to be created in the private sector. And so they're all still interconnected by this push-pull dynamic where they still need each other, but they may not have exactly aligned interests.
Very interesting. I mean, because there's only so much from our vantage point that we can make sense of, okay? And we got quite a far away from Yarvin here. We'll get back to him in a second, but I find this interesting. So let us digress a second. To me, it seemed that COVID and the whole era of COVID was a massive push for centralization and the formalization of power by the globalists class, the Davos crowd, the WEF, you know, the Bill Gates of this world. And it strikes me that the Ukraine war, certainly what's happened in the Middle East, and now Trump and Trump's Dunroe doctrine, as it's being called, was a massive kind of counter grab by the US government, military industrial complex, and Zionism, essentially. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I think that the Trump presidency does represent this element taking the mask off, right? The culture war was in part created to put the mask on. And of course it's still going on, but the mask is being taken off. And that sort of national security state, Zionist intelligence agency element has coalesced around Trump. Yes.
Now, how real, because I, on this channel, I talk a lot about kayfabe, right? And I also am always wary of the school of schizo, okay? The school of schizo, let me just explain a second why I'm against them. The kook sphere, you know, school of schizo, they have a habit of talking about politics in such a way that nothing, like truly nothing ever happens. Everything that happens is a psyop. And, you know, if you take this far enough, it's like, oh, well, actually, even the war in Ukraine is a psyop. Even Putin is on board with them. Even like, I mean, and once you get that level of resolution, it's pointless even talking about politics anymore, because the entire world, to quote Shakespeare, becomes a stage and a fake and gay one. So I never go there. I do actually think that there are genuine interests and genuine splits. And, for example, they don't like Putin, although a certain faction really like that is real, in my view. However, the conflict between the Zionists and the globalists is something that I think is also real. Whenever I say that, there will always be lots of people in the comments, in the chat, saying, you overstate this split between them, and actually they're all part of the same club. To me, as things have gone on, I think that there's something more fundamental there. I think that there are some of the top level globalists are quite committed to an egalitarian vision of a post-world order, okay? And they take things like the rule of law, international law, and so on seriously. And ultimately, if they had more power, they would actually work to prevent Netanyahu and the Zionists and some of the rogue elements around Trump doing whatever they wanted. Okay. What makes it difficult for the likes of us, Todd, is of course we don't really like the globalists either, but we don't like the Zionists either. Okay. And increasingly this seems to be like the game in town. So two questions. One, is it real? Right? Is this conflict actually real, or is it overstated? And two, when push comes to shove, if it's between the Zionists and the globalists, who are you going to side with? Because my view is, in that conflict, you have to go with the globalists and keep them as the end boss, deal with the Zionists first, because there are a great kind of more urgent, immediate threat. And I actually do think they can be defeated as well. Globalists are a harder nut to crack. But, you know, if it's between that lot and that lot, they're both bad. but I think the Zionists are more trouble, personally, and evil. Both evil, but it's like, you know, Skeletor and Hordak or something.
So I do agree that the division is real, but I think what happened is that the division developed over time. So the whole globalist establishment project that begins before the First World War and germinal form, and then of course as the Anglo-American establishment continues to gain worldwide hegemony, they then impose it on the world. At the very beginning of this, you have the Zionists who do side with elements of the British elite in order to get lands in Palestine. And I think partly that's because, you know, they're well-connected, you know, the sort of like they're at the top of the oligarchy. So, you know, the dark elves are still at or near the top of the oligarchy. And they sort of hid their ethnocentric, ethno-supremacist position. And then they sort of like, one of the things you'll see them do is that they'll portray themselves as a kind of universal man. And then they'll what they'll do is they'll give some Holocaust reel, and then they'll say, that's you, that's all of us, right? And so it was a very effective tool until Israel started doing stuff very similar to that, and then they didn't even bother hiding it. And so now I think a lot of what you might call liberals, soft-headed liberals, are like, wait a minute, this is not what we signed up for. We didn't see you guys were going to do this. And now that they get called out, the Zionists are just like, you know, go pound salt. We don't care. You know, we're going to keep doing this no matter what. And so I think what happened was this developed over time. They sort of hid their power level. They sort of were avoiding the more overt displays of power and supremacy. And then, you know, when they thought they were strong enough, or maybe they were desperate enough, they decided to take the mask off. So to that end, that's question one. And what was question two again?
Well, I mean, okay, so if it's a real split, okay, a lot of people are like, well, who do you side with? If you have to pick right. a side, this is the game in town. And honestly, in that calculation, I say you have to go with the globalists over the Zionists at this present time, simply because, I mean, how can I put it? Like, if they get, I think like Palestine is probably like a sneak preview of what will be coming for everybody, you know, given enough time. But it becomes real because, like, for example, you could say, well, Keir Starmer is a Zionist. Like, yeah, but he's not like a Zionist, like Tommy Robinson is a Zionist. You know what I mean? So, when, you know, in this country, there's all this civil war talk. Everybody hates Keir Starmer and so on. And a lot of people say, well, look, if it comes down to it, you have to support the Zionists against the likes of Starmer. My instinct is actually to say probably not. No, I do nothing that helps them ever. But where do you land on this?
Yeah, so I think the difference between the Zionists and the globalists is that there's actually a lot of what we might call dupes or soft-headed people who are liberals on the globalist side who aren't, that, you know, so with the Zionists, they have a much more, I think, nefarious belief system that they've been intentionally hiding from everybody else. Yeah. And that the real motives for what they do are very malevolent. Whereas for a lot of these globalist functionaries, you know, the people in the bureaucracy, a lot of them I think are just dupes. They're not as malevolent as the Zionists. Now, when you look at the actual like architects though of the globalist project, so the Anglo-American establishment in the early 20th century, I think they actually were very malevolent. Of course, those people are long forgotten. And I think on a proactive level, right, if you can't take on both at the same time, I would agree with you that the Zionists are the bigger threat, because they're more likely to use force to upend the entire order and then cause unlimited chaos. See, with as much as, you know, we can say bad things about the Biden administration and the Obama administration, compared to, like, say, the hard power of the Zionists in Gaza, they're just not going to do that. They're just not going to do that. They do other things that are bad, but, like, they're not going to firebomb Gaza, right? And what did the neocons do? They did that to Iraq and Afghanistan. Right, this kind of complete flattening and leveling of whole areas just shows that they're far more willing to hurt people on a massive scale like that, without even trying to hide it. right? The sort well, of, yeah.
And I hate to move into a little bit of a current thing, politics, Todd, right? But, you know, for me, I mean, again, I'm quite removed from it over here. So it's just an American domestic news story. I try as much as possible not to comment on domestic stuff. I tend to try to keep my U.S. comments to foreign policy, okay? Because that's what affects everybody more. However, it was almost impossible to ignore the fact that, you know, this ICE officer shot this woman, okay? It was all over our news. And at the moment, my phone is broken, so I have my radio stuck on this channel, LBC. It's a shit-lib radio station. But literally, it was wall-to-wall. These are Trump's brown shirts. This is wanton violence, blah, blah, blah. And this, pretty much everybody was agreed. This was a British channel. But when I go on my Twitter feed, I'm, you know, I haven't watched any videos. I'm not going to study, you know, look at this angle and that angle. I don't care about all that. What I saw was a lot of people losing their humanity in really basic terms, okay? I mean, whether she was a full-on left-wing activist or what, this was still a mother of three. And now you've got people who, because of politics, are cheering on her death, or memeing it, or being disrespectful about it, or trying to justify it, et cetera, et cetera. And to come back to what we were talking about just now, I did wonder, like, is this the first glimmerings of what we're talking about, of this kind of Israeli mindset? Struck me as pretty Israeli, to be honest, of just having like a wanton disregard for other human beings. Because if it's between that and, you know, suffering a couple of lesbians or whatever, I'll take the latter, because it's just not cool. It's not, you know, not something I'm going to support. What do you think about this?
Well, what's interesting here about these ICE, you know, that incident, the broader policies of ICE, is that, you know, this isn't the first time that the U.S. government has intentionally deported large members of the population that were immigrants. So, for example, Eisenhower did that with Mexican workers for, I think, was the Bracero program. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is there wasn't really a lot of violence, right? And partly because this was a country before the Culture War. Both Democrats and Republicans were more or less on board with this, and it was an orderly process. I think the reason why that over 50 years ago was so much different than what's going on now is a reflection of the deep divides in this country. And, you know, you just wouldn't have in Eisenhower's America, even with a massive deportation program, police just trigger happy shooting people down. That, you know, that didn't happen when he sent the Mexican migrant workers back to Mexico. So there is a sense in which the U.S. security forces are more willing to use violence than they would have been before. Mm-hmm. Now, that also needs to be bracketed with the idea that if you look at, so when there was all the liberals would make all the rows about, you know, the various black men that were shot and killed by police from like 2008 to 2020, you look at the actual number of people killed by police in the United States, it's a very low number. Now, you might say, okay, that doesn't excuse bad policies that get people killed. That's true. But we also need to be clear, though, that there aren't really that many people being directly killed, unlike, say, in a totalitarian state where the security forces will just, you know, think of like hunger in 1956. It's not hunger in 1956.
Iran right now, right?
Yeah, or Iran right now. And so what I would say is, could it be? Yeah. I mean, that's the Zionist MO. They do it in Gaza and Palestine. But will it happen here? I think that's a little more of an open question.
Yeah, I mean, I should mention that the dominant talking point in LBC was to say that this happened because, in a sense, it was a Trump publicity stunt, and the personnel just weren't, well, you know, they've been given like 2 days of training and stuck out there or something. They're not well trained, essentially, and that's why these kind of mistakes, this is why stuff like this is happening, because they haven't had the relevant kind of let's get back to Yarvin and Moldbug. Then I've noticed that his line in recent weeks has been, look, Trump hasn't worked. The Trump revolution hasn't happened, right? But it's still the last shot that we've got. I.e., if the Libs get back in, we're all going to jail. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but what's he up to, Todd? Why is Yarvin saying this at the moment?
Well, see, this is interesting, right? Because this ties into a whole lot of things. If we're going to run with the theory that the sort of national security state, Trump and the Zionists, the Dark Elves, are all working together like that, one of the things that is right-coded is, you know, border sovereignty. And so a lot of right-wing guys are encouraged to join ICE. But what ends up happening, though, is ultimately who are they downstream from? Right? Well, you know, Trump got a lot of money from Miriam Adelson, right? In order to get for his second term. And so ultimately, what I think Trump represents is a sort of like heritage American mask for the Dark Elves to get disaffected right-wing American men to do their bidding. And then you scare them into place with what you just said, you know, oh, hey, if Trump loses, I'm sorry, he can't run again. If whoever comes after Trump doesn't win as a Republican, we're all going to jail. That's sort of like scaring them back into line, right? I'm not saying that the concerns that are being manipulated are illegitimate concerns. But what I'm saying is they're being sold and packaged in a particular way that gets right-wing men who are disaffected to just not think about certain things and just follow the orders of people that they think they're actually resisting. And I think this is a good example because Trump is sort of like the heritage American mask for the Dark Elves.
Yeah, very interesting. And one of the questions I've asked in recent weeks, I remember I put a tweet up and I said, look, it's pretty disgusting, the sort of stuff that Matt Walsh is saying, right? Not just about that shooting, but about pretty much everything that's happened in the past couple of weeks. And I said, look, he's got an excuse, though, which means he's paid big bucks by Ben Shapiro to put this shit out there. What's your excuse? Why are you, Chud, sitting there at home on your iPhone or something, doing it for free? What the hell's wrong with you? I mean, so it clearly works, is what I'm saying. It's like some aspect of this playbook is working. A question I've got, though, is that are we starting to see the beginning of the end? I mean, to me, the past couple of weeks have started to make the Chuds look very uncool. They've started to make the Chuds seem really tiresome. And, you know, you could say, well, if there's been a quote-unquote vibe shift, there's been a pretty big vibe shift. Okay, not everybody, but the people who aren't on board are pretty like, yeah, we're not really up for this anymore. Joke is not funny. Increasingly, it's just unpleasant. Is it already over for Yarvin and friends in a sense, because Democrats are coming back, aren't they? Or doesn't it matter?
Yeah, I think the Democrats are coming back is a bit of an overstatement. So we have a historical empirical example of this. Biden gets in 2000. And, right. and while certainly for those who were involved in the January 6th incident, that was very bad. We can argue that might have been kayfabe. So maybe you shouldn't have gone there in the first place. But for most people, you know, they didn't open up the jails and then put all these Americans in the jails. That's not, you know, Biden did a lot of things I didn't like, but he didn't do that, right? And so it's unlikely that whoever the next Democrat is will do that. What I think actually is causing the vibe shift and exposing the Chuds is let's look at, you know, the online right is, you know, beginning in 2007 and going up till now, has defined itself in opposition to the establishment because it acts against the interests of men and heritage Americans. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing this alteration where some are like, no, we totally love the establishment now. We're going to, you know, forever war forever. And it's like, well, we already saw the forever war with the Bush administration, with the neoconservatives. And a lot of people don't want that anymore. In fact, that was a big part of the original MAGA base. We don't want any more of these wars. And that's why Trump got elected in 2016, because he said he wasn't going to start anymore. Yeah. He at least told the truth then, though he has since walked that back. And I think ultimately the actions of the Chuds themselves have revealed this. the Venezuela, we talked about this before, but when they all came in behind the Trump regime change, well, it's not even regime change because the party is still in power that represents Maduro. But the point is they spun it as regime change. They spun it as a strong American action in that part of the world. And it's like, okay, well, who? Let's say you do replace Maduro and you put in an American puppet. Who is it going to be? A Zionist shill. The very group of people that you've spent the last 15 years fighting. And at that moment, I think we all realize that this is what the plan was. You have now, you know, dissident right online men supporting Zionism. Because yes. A thing is what a thing does. And if yes. you support that, you support Zionism. So it's like you've got the egg on your face. You've got the pie in your face. You walked right into this and you didn't even think. And see, that's the key thing. They didn't think. It was just, they were just, you know, consuming content, vibing, just doing their thing. And all of a sudden now you're on the side of the Zionist dark elves saying, hey, we need to regime change Maduro. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
What about, I mean, since then, there's also been the protests in Iran, which seem like they've been overstated. One of the things that struck me is that people who've spent the past 2 or 3 years when it came to the Palestinians and it came to Israel saying, oh, I don't care what happens in the Middle East. I just don't care. Those exact same people have now come out and been like, yeah, they're for this regime change. And, oh, I hope the Iranians get their liberation. You know, and this, if ever an operation was purely Israel-backed, this idea that there's going to be protests and the Shah's son's going to come back and replace the mullahs is about as blatant as a Zionist operation I've ever seen. But a lot of the same people who got behind the Venezuela stuff are now also like, I really hope that the women of Iran get their OnlyFans, right? I mean, after spending 3 years saying they don't care what happens in the Middle East, well, now they care. Why didn't you just come out and say it? Like, you were just a Zionist all along. You're just doing the bidding of them. Just say it.
Yeah, and that's the other mask off, too, right? Because who wants regime change in Iran? Well, we all know who really... I mean, do we have to go back to the Project for a New American Century and Pearl and Crystal and all these people? We know who these people are. And so one of the things that you had said before Trump's second term was you said that the woke would be put away. And one of the reasons you gave was that they need white men to fight in their armies. Correct. Yes, and that's exactly what happened. And so the receipts are in on your prediction. But the point is here, they wanted these white chuds to then become cannon fodder in a war in the Middle East again. And a lot of these thought leaders are, I mean, you know, we see it all over X, you know. They're like, oh, yeah, we hope we get the Shah back. You know, I got the Iranian art hose, you know, all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, try telling me you're a Zionist harder, right? I mean, so all of these guys, the Dark Elves aren't going to do the fighting themselves. That's the point. They need someone else to do the fighting, which is you. And so the reason, so all this convoluted, you know, UR stuff, Gray Mirror stuff, Dark Elves and Super Protestants and Carlisle, all this, is to program you to get ready to go overseas and fight in Iran or to crush dissent at home. That's and sadly, we're seeing guys who are so lacking in self-awareness that, you know, on social media, they don't see it. They just keep pushing it. Now, maybe, you know, they're getting paid to say it, in which case we just don't know where the money's coming from. Or they're hoping to get paid for it, you know, a la Moldbug, right? Oh, if you just, you know, beg the leader hard enough, he'll give you some more money. Or they're just tone deaf, you know. But regardless, it's been very disappointing. And Venezuela and Iran really were mask off, showing us that these guys just walked right on the rake.
One of the things that annoys me, Todd, is that I'm frequently called, oh, you're just being a contrarian, are you? Just being a contrarian. In my view, I'm not being a contrarian. I'm just explaining what's happening. Well, why am I so frequently called a contrarian? Is anything we've said contrarianism, or is it just kind of sticking to the authentic line that opposes the gay?
Well, I think I would agree. We are just doing the standard line that opposing the GAE. But I think why do people, because I've also been called contrarian a lot over the years. And I think what that means is you are saying something that people can't process. And they do kind of paint by numbers. They pigeonhole you, right? So they have, you know, think of like you're in kindergarten, you got these little cubby holes where you just keep pigeonholing stuff in the cubby holes. And it's like people don't have enough cubby holes to account for these ideas. And so we just get pigeonholed into that last one, the contrarian one, because they can't put it anywhere else. That would be what we might call a skill gap. You know, you don't have the level of awareness or consciousness to realize that there's more holes to put these things in. I think that's the simplest explanation.
Last question. Can anything stop them? And do you think they're going to get their way? Because I know there's the so-called curse of the eighth decade. That's coming in 2 years' time. It strikes me that at the moment, they're going hell for leather on every front. Literally throwing everything they can at the wall at the moment. Hard to say if this is like a major kind of strategic masterstroke or a bit of kind of headless chicken panic, right? I can't really tell. But to come back to Yavin and to come back to all the things we were talking about, ultimately, will all of these efforts being for naught, you know, in 10 years' time, or will you look back on this as their kind of last hour, final hour type thing? Or are they just going to win?
I think that the Zionists are acting this way because they believe that time is running out. This kind of activity that you see on both sides of the Atlantic is that it's rushed, it's extreme, it's not really well thought out, right? This is not like a calm and cool and collected strategist making long-term plays, like say Mao. Right. This is exaggerated. This is frenetic. All of that says to me that these people feel that their time is running out because they're acting like they're under pressure. They're acting like things are really bad. So I would say that they think they are running out of time.
Interesting. But do you think they're going to win anyway?
No, I don't think they're going to win. I think if we look at the Eastern branch in the Middle East, going with Kevin McDonald's thesis, they keep winning because they keep dividing everybody. That was Kevin McDonald's thesis. The Dark Elves stay in power and dominate because they divide everyone else to fight each other rather than them. But as the mass keeps slipping, and of course the Middle East is mostly Muslim already, so you won't need a huge amount of effort to unite Muslims against that threat. I think that's a game you can't win. You can't play that game forever. At some point, you will lose the game because everybody else is going to realize that Britain did this in Europe, and they kept pitting great powers against each other in order to keep them off Britain's back. But of course, World War II was a bridge too far. The empire got bankrupted and fell apart. So we know that this game can't last. Now, will it dissolve in our lifetimes? I not only hope so, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, just to wrap up on this, because, I mean, yeah, we're talking about Yavin, but there's a lot of things going on at the moment, and we're having an interesting conversation. You know, there's this thing about Greenland that keeps on coming back again and again. Some general from the French, the retired general from France, had said that Greenland is a red line for France. It would be the end of NATO. British government has dug in over it. The Danish government has dug in over it. The coverage over here for that is like, yeah, this is just can't happen. Pretty serious figures, like the former British defense minister. I did a thing last week where I covered one of his appearances, and you know, this guy's a psycho, right? I mean, he said, oh, you know, we used to have to kill people, blah blah blah, without batting an eyelid, okay? But for him, he was like, yeah, this is a step too far. So that's happening at the moment. Like Europe is being antagonized by this sort of activity. But on that same radio show I listened to, and I've been forced to listen to it a lot recently because it's just stuck on the radio, right? A Chinese guy came on, some Chinese professor, from Beijing. And he said, look, this action in Venezuela, when viewed from 200 years hence, people will look back on this as the beginning of the end. And China knows what's happening. It can, you know, it sees the direction of travel, and people will see this as the beginning of the end of the American Empire, and we will take Taiwan, you know, on a time and date of our choosing. We control the timeline. And he said it in this kind of really calm way. And I was thinking, and with a level of certainty that I found vaguely disconcerting. And maybe this is just like a Chinese rhetorical strategy or something, but his calmness was in stark contrast to this kind of panicked, headless chickenism that we see from Washington, from Trump, and from, you know, his friend in the Middle East that, you know, orchestrating so much of this. Is the Chinese guy right? Is this the beginning of the end?
I do. I think it is. I think that we know how the Anglo-American establishment historically knows how to act from a position of certainty, to be calm, cool, and collected. I mean, look at the public statements of FDR or JFK. Now, or even, you know, even when Bill Clinton was still, you know, riding the wave of the end of history. But look at it now, right? Everybody's just like ready to snap, right? There's no sense of certainty, control, understanding of the way things are going like it was in the past when they really did have much more control over the country and the world due to their connections and influence and money. And a lot of that, you see, a lot of that doesn't work anymore. And I think that's what's really scaring these people, because they still have a lot of money. They still have a lot of hard power, but like it doesn't work the way it used to. And they're struggling to figure out how to use these tools in ways that will get the results that they want. The problem is most people, and this is only increasing over time as they keep acting like this, it's a negative feedback loop, are getting to see through all this. And so it's like you're just going to have to invent a whole new tool set, and they're not willing to do that. Yeah.
To come back to Yarvin, one of the things that he predicted at one point, I don't know if he still talks about this, is he said, look, eventually America will have to come together under Blue Caesar, not Red Caesar, and that the red America's story of America will have to be kind of erased, and the blue story will win. Now I don't hear him talking along these lines anymore, but this is what he said during the Biden years, right? And I keep on waiting for the left to make this move, and they still haven't done it. I thought Biden would do it. I thought Keir Starmer would do it. They haven't done it yet. Which is basically to say, like, look, you've seen the right in power. They've totally discredited themselves. The adults are back in the room now. Okay, woke and all this sort of stuff went too far, but, you know, come on. We're going to put the ship back together. We're going to make sure this right-wing nut job stuff doesn't happen again. Okay, make a few examples. But basically, you know, we're going to write the empire. We're going to write the government. We're going to write everything. But we're going to do it in the name of, you know, a kind of progressive, you know, Blairite kind of vision. But they haven't done that either. Is there a prospect of something like that happening in your view, or is the left too far gone as well?
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting that Moldbug has pivoted in this way, because I don't think that, and we see this also with Europe as well, and they're struggling to define themselves both against Putin and Trump at the same time. There's a sense in which they're not really capable of action. Right. We can speak of a kind of muscular liberalism during World War One and Two with the British and Americans, and even into the early parts of the Cold War. But it's gone by like the 80s, because most of the quote unquote muscular elements of the Anglo-American establishment are basically right wing coded. Right. Most of the people that join the U.S. military come from right wing coded areas. I mean, of course, there's New York State and California they're just big states, right? But otherwise, they're mostly red coated, because those are places that still have men of action. Now they're working for people that I think are working against their interests, and I think Moldbug is a part of that. But the left, they tried their power play. That was COVID, and it just completely blew up on their face in Europe and the United States.
Not just COVID, BLM as well. Don't forget BLM.
Yeah, don't forget that. Yeah. So, I mean, I think they did try. And then what happened was, so back in 2018, I think there was the walk away movement. So there were Democrats who were leaving the Democratic Party, the sort of like moderate leftist types that you know, we can still talk to, because they weren't crazy, right? They didn't drink all that Kool-Aid. And those people, they left. And I think there's no like data that I can point to, but the impression I get is that they've come into the Republican Party. I mean, some of them actually did, like Tulsi Gabbard, right? And RFK Jr. And so the idea then becomes they left. So the same people on the left are leaving the left, right? The Democrats. And then everybody saw that this overreach, yeah, with BLM, with COVID, and the very draconian measures, you know, you will own nothing and be happy, the idea of like vaccine passports, it all had like, you know, depending on your subculture, Mark of the Beast vibes or 1984 vibes. And it's like
Trudeau and the truckers, remember?
Yeah. And it blew up in their face, because ultimately nobody was really willing to enforce that. So I think they tried, actually. I think that's what happened.
But yeah, I mean, I guess the question is that it for them, or can't they have another go?
I would argue that ultimately they're done, because based on a broader assessment of our situation, based on collapse, which I use Tainter's definition, going from a higher energy state to a lower energy state, all the left-wing coalition elements of the new left rely on a high energy state. In a low energy state, you don't find these crazy people, because they can't exist. And as not only the US, but the entire world goes into a low energy state, you're basically starving the fire. You're taking oxygen out of the room, so that, you know, eventually they just won't even be able to exist, because you've asphyxiated the flame. Now, what can they do in the next 5 years? Well, I don't know. But like in the next 50 years, they're done.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I guess my question is more, can a force come along to steady the ship, to right the... Because it's obvious at the moment that America is a fucking clown show, okay? But also increasingly that European politics is a farce as well. Everything is becoming really clown-coded across the board, regardless of what it is, okay? And, you know, I mean, our politicians from the left now are just like every day, like feuding with Elon Musk. You know, they're going to ban X and all this sort of stuff. But it's still clown world. It's still clown world stuff. What I'm looking for, or what I'm wondering about, is the possibility of the ruling class, the current ruling class, to just kind of revert back to just being we're sensible and serious. We're not going to engage in this stupid stuff anymore that populism has brought about. Clown show, as I call it. We're going to start behaving, you know, in a much more adult manner, et cetera, because that's the other thing. Whenever I see the Chinese talk anywhere, they really seem adult, mature, calm, unflappable, serious, whereas none of our leaders do, left or right. And I guess that's the question. I mean, is it possible for any of our leaders to, I can't believe I'm saying this, be more like the Chinese ones?
Well, I think what we would have to say is that we're waiting for new leaders. I think the problem we have is we have these octogenarians who just won't get out of power. They were long past their expiration date. You go to the grocery store shelf, this thing should have been thrown off the shelf 20 years ago. And the problem is they live in like a period of time in the 60s and 70s when things were a lot simpler, and they still can't fully comprehend how technology and all these other things have changed society. And it's not likely that they could change. I wouldn't say it's impossible. I mean, you know, Constantine went from a pagan to a Christian, but unlikely. I think the next generation that will replace them, that depends on the matter of the replacement. Is it going to be a peaceful transfer of power through electoral politics, or is it going to be a violent struggle? Either way, those two demographics that would represent a future elite, I think, do have the potential to be serious again. Because I think ultimately, in order to deal with the challenges that we face today, all of them, you have to become serious. And it creates a filter, an environmental filter, which just weeds out all the unserious people so that eventually the only people left standing are the serious ones.
I mean, you say that though, Todd, but we've seen Dan and Bongo. What's his name? Dan Bongo.
Dan Bongino.
right. What was he? Assistant director of the FBI. Then he left and now he's gone back to be a podcaster. Talk about bloody clown world.
I know.
Assistant FBI director to podcaster. Well, without skipping a beat. I mean, it's not going that well for him, but. This is he's younger, right? He's not an octave, he's a younger. And I'm like, oh God, you know, is the future a future where now basically your ruling class is Tim Pool? You know, the theater kids.
Well, the other factor to consider then is a lot of this clownish behavior is living in the cash nexus. So you have to do this to get people to give you money. You know, and so the people that got in, either because they understood technology, so the nerds, right, or the entertainers who knew how they could generate clout and then bring people with money to them, those two groups feed into this. But what happens is that there are other people that are outside because they didn't understand how to manipulate the system that we don't see. But I think are more serious. It's a selection bias. So if society props up certain groups of people, i.e. people that know how to play the game society is giving them, they're going to be seen first. It's like, you know, seeing a herd of animals and you see that leader of the herd first. What you don't see is who follows up the tail. And those are the people that you're not going to see for a while because society has been holding them down because they don't fit the expectations. But then everything just kind of falls apart and goes off the skids. The downward force is removed. And if they're still alive, they can then stand up and be serious. But we won't see them for a while because, again, the downward pressure and then also the distraction. You know, we're watching the magician waving his hand. Meanwhile, the real events going behind the scenes we don't see.
All right. Very interesting conversation, Todd. Any final thoughts on Irvin?
Well, I'll just say that what I've said before, if somebody who is smart does something that looks stupid, he's doing something else. And so I think that what Irvin did is he played the right in order to get these disaffected right-wing men to be willing to fight and die for the Zionist Dark Elves. Now, will he succeed? We don't know yet.
Fascinating. Where can people find you, Todd?
They can find me on at POF Podcast on X and on YouTube at the Praise of Foley Podcast.
Fantastic. And I hope us doing the interviews mean more people are finding their way across to your channel because you do very deep dives. And in a way, we're just scratching the surface with these talks. I'll remind people to pick up on pre-order. It's been pushed back. They're really going to town on this. And they're kind of like, how can I say, they're being a bit perfectionist on it, Todd. It was due to come out like this month or next month. It's just been pushed back a couple of months because they want to get certain things right. So this is just a prototype, believe it or not. So, yeah, but it's available on pre-order. Pick that up now. promo code Shorejang gets you 25% off all courses. And catch you next time.
See ya.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.